Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program here. We're delighted to have with us today a very distinguished panel of experts to talk about the topic of Cuba's foreign policy under the Raul Castro administration. We have with us H. Michael Erisman, who's professor of political science at Indiana State University in Terre Haute, whose expertise is Cuba, Cuban foreign policy in the post-Soviet world, and is also the co-editor of a new book on Cuban medical internationalism. He has a PhD from Pennsylvania State University and an MA from that same organization. He's the author of many publications on Cuba. Dr. Suzanne Gracius is a senior researcher for the Fundación para las Relaciones Internacionales y el Diálogo Exterior, FRIDE, in Madrid, who is a specialist on peace, security, and human rights, has a very broad background in Latin American and Cuban affairs, and holds a PhD in political science from the University of Hamburg. And Dr. John Kirk, who is a professor at the Department of Spanish at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, who has published several books on Cuba, including books co-authored and co-edited with Dr. Erisman. So we have a very dynamic duo of Cuban experts here who have worked together on a number of important projects. Dr. Kirk's PhD comes from the University of British Columbia in Latin American Studies. And these are all experts who have had the opportunity to track Cuba and to analyze Cuban affairs for a long period of time. So it's a real pleasure and honor to have them here, and I'm also very grateful to all of you for having come. As is our practice, we will go in alphabetical order, beginning with Professor Erisman.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, if you just bear with me for a second. Okay, I'm really not a PowerPoint person, but I tried to put something together here, okay? And this is a very sensitive pad that I'm working with, so if it gets extremely confusing, why just let me know. Actually, this works out fairly well because I'm going to try and do kind of a macro perspective on Cuban foreign relations, some central threads, central concerns that have helped to mold and shape Cuba's foreign relations, and then try and relate them a little bit to the whole issue of normalization of U.S.-Cuban relations, and particularly point out perhaps some complications in that process. So let me just start kind of introducing this macro perspective approach. The essential dynamics, I think, of any country's foreign policy often involves kind of an interplay between elements of continuity and elements of change. And in general, I think, the tendency among observers is to focus on change. It's more interesting. It's more dramatic. Business rather than business as usual, if you will. But the fact is, elements of continuity will remain a part of the overall policy landscape that really can't be overlooked in any comprehensive analysis. As historians say, the present is a product of the past, and this cautionary note, I think, holds true when looking at revolutionary Cuba, where basic elements of its foreign relations have persisted over time, and so you can kind of look at specific initiatives can often be analyzed and understood by viewing them in terms of the broader perspective that looks at their interplay with these continuities that characterize the larger policy agenda. So I'm going to try and apply that principle here with respect to looking at the prospects for normalization of U.S.-Cuban relations. So continuities, in other words, involve broad themes, broad concerns that persist over time. And well, okay. Basically what it is a cartoon, a kind of a continuity, okay? Kind of a cartoon here, an example of a continuity, Fidel listening to the radio, Saddam Hussein has been a thorn in the side of two U.S. administrations, with Fidel's response, of course, being amateur. In terms of some change, Again, another thing to lighten things up a little bit. Change is not always, of course, accepted. It can create problems. But in any case, I just wanted to start on a light note, okay, before we got too heavily into this. Basically, in terms of continuities, I break it down into three categories, and not three terribly innovative categories, to be very honest with you. Promoting and protecting, these are ongoing concerns. Promoting and protecting effective sovereignty, promoting and protecting economic security, and promoting international influence, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with Nye's work on soft power, okay? And then what I want to look at here is looking at each of these three areas a little bit and then looking at some of the policy manifestations, how these things have perhaps affected Cuba's foreign policy or foreign relations. So defining effective sovereignty, which you could perhaps call a kind of nationalistic sentiment, if you would, but minimizing the political system's vulnerability to external penetration. Again, the idea of controlling one's own destiny, if you will. And some of the policy manifestations of this are the centrality of what I call counterdependency politics. In other words, trying to build coalitions to, in effect, acquire bargaining power in terms of one's international relations. There is certain negotiating rigidity, I think, rooted in certain ideological principles that come into play here. So what I'm saying here is that these, if you will, nationalistic aspirations involving maximization of effective sovereignty, I think are deeply rooted not only in the government, but in the larger society's political culture. You can trace this sentiment back to the very earliest days of the Cuban independence struggle. And obviously this is a problem, which as we'll see later, is going to complicate U.S.-Cuban relations and perhaps complicate the whole process of normalization. Excuse me. In terms of economic security, again, I believe you already had a session on economics, did you not? So again, this is just very quick, very down and dirty type of stuff. But you're looking at growth plus diversification. In terms of Cuba's economic performance, there I did it. This just gives you a very general idea of the performance of the Cuban economy over since about 1990. Obviously, the early bars there are what they call the special period, when Cuba was having terrible economic problems. And then you can see since about 1994, 1995, things have been improving. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Cuban economy is in great shape. Their foreign debt has been expanding. But nevertheless, it gives you some rough idea of how the Cuban economy has been performing, how they've been doing in terms of economic security. In terms of, again, looking at a few other things here, if you look at their export earnings, one time, of course, Cuba was was essentially dependent on export of sugar. Now, as you can see, it's more diversified with tourism, nickel, professional services. Some of that, of course, will be medical people who are abroad. John and I, as I think it was mentioned, have just finished up a book on Cuba's international medical programs. So obviously they have, in a sense, diversified their export structure. If you look at the diversification of trade partners, you can see here, obviously, during the Cold War, it would have been the Soviet Union and the Eastern European states. Now, again, this is 2006. It's sometimes hard to get really up-to-date figures, but Venezuela, China, Spain, and interestingly enough, the United States down there included on this list. Okay? So it gives you some idea of what they've been doing in terms of dealing with the issue of economic growth, economic diversification, particularly in terms of their international economic relations. And then I think something that John will talk about later on would be the special Venezuelan relationship. So I'm not going to get into that because I think some others are going to touch on that. Then the last thing we can look at is international influence, acquiring and exercising soft power. Some of the policy manifestations of this would be the developmental aid programs that we already mentioned, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, ALBA, which is not only a relationship between Cuba and Venezuela, as you all know, but it's also, in a sense, a program which is designed to, which they hope to spread, let's put it that way, into other parts of Latin America. I believe there are now five members of ALBA, okay? Brazil, not Brazil, Bolivia, Honduras, and, pardon? Nicaragua. Okay, thank you. Oh, Antigua's come in? Okay, well, in any case. And then, of course, their long-term involvement in the non-aligned movement, not only participating in it, but leading the movement twice, one time in late 70s, early 80s, which didn't turn out too well. And then most recently, Cuba is currently the chair, if you will, of the non-aligned movement. So, again, some examples of attempting to put into practice this idea of promoting and protecting international influence. Okay, now, then what I try to do is take these three areas, okay, and say, well, how might these affect the whole process of normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba? And the conventional wisdom, I think, suggests that Havana would readily embrace the opportunity to normalize its relations with the United States, get the economic blockade lifted. Obviously, such a normalization would generate very fundamental changes in the configuration and dynamics of the revolution's foreign policy, foreign relations. Among other things, the emergence of the United States, probably, as the island's premier trading partner. Increasing reliance by Cuba on the United States as a main source of private investment, consolidation of international tourism, perhaps, as a leading economic sector, et cetera, et cetera. But what I'm suggesting here is that countervailing considerations may exist that could render Havana's enthusiasm for normalization a bit more uncertain than is perhaps often assumed. So what I want to do to finish up here is to explore some potential countervailing considerations within this framework of continuities that we talked about and see where problems may arise. Not necessarily from the American side of the equation, but from the Cuban side of the equation in terms of normalization. Okay, with regard to the international influence concerns, I don't think there's any serious problems or complications here. In other words, normalization of relations is not necessarily going to have any adverse impact on this, or this isn't going to create any problems. I said a minor concern could be the perceived negative impact on the symbolic value of Cuba's image as a Caribbean David who confronts the U.S. Goliath. Obviously, if you normalize relations, it's a little bit more difficult to play that particular role. Okay, but in general, I don't see any problems there. Okay, in terms of some economic complications here, and here I do think there are some problems. As the U.S. and Cuba perhaps try and work out a more normalized relationship, one of the problems here has been, at least in the past, the United States' reluctance to offer trade reciprocity. In other words, a lot of the discussion of opening up relations, economic relations between the United States and Cuba, and particularly, like I say, economic relations, has been the idea that this will provide an opportunity for American companies to sell goods and services to Cuba. And of course, we've seen, in fact, that has happened with the United States being, what, the number five trading partner. A lot of that, I think, is agricultural things that are sold to Cuba, okay? But the question has been, if you look at it from the Cuban perspective, has there been trade reciprocity? Has there been talk of opening up the American market to Cuban goods and services? And the answer to that is usually no, okay, at least as it has played out thus far. For example, when Congress, I think, has talked about easing trade with Cuba, they've been talking about easing trade from the United States to Cuba and not necessarily vice versa. So, again, that might be a problem. The willingness of U.S. Enterprises to make non-tourism investments, we'll get to tourism in a minute. Again, what I was suggesting there, I think if perhaps one looks at the larger Caribbean, at one time, these are usually fairly small markets. There might not be a lot of demand for goods and services in these markets, which would attract U.S. capital. At one time, of course, I think the United States companies looked at the Caribbean in general as kind of being low-cost manufacturing export platforms to service the U.S. market, but of course with NAFTA, that now brings Mexico to the forefront in terms of being a manufacturing and perhaps export platform into the U.S. economy. So there may be some problems there. Tourism, again, in a general sense, yes, you can say that this would be a major economic boon to the United States, to Cuba, rather. If you look at the figures, I think they talk about perhaps 5 million tourists at one point in time. And this, again, this would move tourism to the forefront. One of the problems with tourism, at least in the Caribbean, is that there's an awful lot of leakage of tourism dollars. In other words, they don't stay in the host countries, okay? Because very often the main areas of tourist expenditures, air travel, hotels, and food and associated things in the Caribbean are often controlled by U.S. companies, okay, who are involved in Caribbean tourism. So people fly to the Caribbean on U.S. airlines. They often stay at U.S.-owned hotels. And so that money doesn't necessarily stay in the host nation, if you will. There's a lot of leakage there. Anywhere from maybe 35 to as high as 60-70%. In some estimates, okay? So again, and the other obvious problem there is a negative social impact of tourism. Again, those of you who are familiar with Cuba or perhaps have been there know that there has been kind of a resurgence of prostitution in Cuba related to the tourism industry and people's desire to get the hard currencies that are available in the tourism industry. And then there's kind of a question of an internal brain drain. Highly trained people leaving their regular jobs and, in a sense, moving over into the tourism sector, again, in order to get access to hard currency. The other kind of wild card in this whole thing is Cuba's oil resources. As maybe many of you know, there are indications that there are now substantial oil reserves off the Cuban coast. We're talking about oil reserves, perhaps as large as those that the United States have. I think they talk somewhere around 9 billion barrels of oil that are available. And again, this might be a better source of economic security. In other words, this would lessen, to a certain extent, perhaps, Cuba, the economic imperative for Cuba to normalize relations with the U.S. The third thing, and I think the area of most serious complications, have to do with this effective sovereignty area. Again, continued centralization of political power in Cuba. The United States has long said that in order to fully normalize relations, there have to be various reforms in Cuba, not only economic reforms, but political reforms. And, of course, that clashes directly with this idea of protecting and enhancing your effective sovereignty. Cuba's refusal to negotiate within what they're now calling a carrot and stick framework. But historically, when the United States has talked about normalizing relations with Cuba, we've often talked about certain preconditions that have to be met by Cuba in order for that normalization process to move forward. At one time, these were mostly foreign affairs concerns. Cuba's military relationship with the Soviet Union, Cuba's troops in Africa, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, as Wayne Smith said, once those issues kind of faded, the United States, says Wayne, kind of moved the goalposts and then began talking about various internal changes that have to take place within Cuba. And today that's sometimes talked about in terms of a carrot and stick framework, that if the Cuba does this, the United States will extend the carrot. If they don't, we will kind of maintain the embargo and other things. And the Cubans are not going to accept this. They've never accepted it in the past. They're probably not going to accept it today. Raul Castro recently says that he wants to end the decade-long chill between Havana and Washington, but insists that he will not submit to carrot-and-stick manipulation. He says, we are not in a hurry. We are not desperate. And, of course, we will not talk with the carrot and the stick. That is over. We're open to dialogue with Mr. Obama wherever and when he decides, but under absolute equal conditions, without even the slightest shadow over our sovereignty. And the Cubans have talked that language for years and years and years. This is not a change. This is something that you consistently find there. And I think the final thing is sometimes a tendency in the United States to present normalization as a vehicle for regime or systemic change. In other words, if we open relations with Cuba and Americans begin traveling there and Cubans begin to know more about our system, that will somehow generate some kind of change within Cuba. Political change, i.e. to a more Western-style democratic system, which, of course, would threaten, in a sense, the larger, the existence of the revolution itself, okay? So what I'm suggesting then, that's it, what I'm suggesting here is that it's going to be a more complicated process in terms of normalizing U.S.-Cuban relations, and that one has to obviously look at it from the perspective of both parties. And if you look at it from the Cuban perspective, there are potential complications. There are potential problems. So it is going to have to be a process characterized by reciprocity, by serious bargaining and negotiation on the part of both sides. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gracious.
First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. Because it's not so usual that you invite Europeans to a discussion on Cuba. So I think this is also a sign that something is changing in Washington and in Washington's Cuba policy. Let me just ask the organizers for an extra 5 minutes to justify the high costs of my travel arrangement to go here. And I think Mr. Erisman also had some 5 minutes more than... Okay. So I think not social progress, but Cuba's foreign policy has been the real success story of the regime, because for 50 years, the Cuban Revolution survived in economic terms by strong external allies and in political terms by the external threat or U.S. hostility. So I think somewhat paradoxically, the United States has been and is still the key factor in Cuba's foreign policy, precisely because of non-relations with Washington. Cuba has been able to create a real independent policy and to justify an independent policy based on an external threat. So I think U.S. sanctions served both as an argument for ideological, both for ideological alliances with U.S. hostile regimes, first Russia, then China, and today Venezuela, and also to justify political cohesion in a closed political regime with this image of fortaleza sitiada, or the external threat. So I think within this particular bilateral framework, it's very easy, so I would do the next. So within this very particular bilateral framework, Cuba's policy experienced remarkable changes, and these changes in Cuba's foreign policy marks a very sharp contrast to this political continuity under the Castro brothers. So we have in the 60s a kind of third worldism. In the 70s and 80s, a strategic alliance with the former Soviet Union. In the 90s, the diversification, but a certain strategic alliance with China, and also the Europeans going into the Cuban market. From 2000 on, we have a strategic alliance with Venezuela and a certain Latin Americanization of Cuba's foreign policy. Let me just say a word on Venezuela. I wouldn't overestimate the strategic alliance between Cuba and Venezuela, because if we think about the historic relations between Cuba and the Soviet Union, I think it was not ideology, it was more the economic aspect of relations which has been the key for this alliance. The same is true for Venezuela. I think it's more the economic aspects, I mean, to get cheap oil or oil on special conditions and to send services to Venezuela, doctors and teachers mainly, but also military personnel to Venezuela. I think this is the real essence of the strategic alliance with Venezuela. We also should think about that this alliance with Venezuela started under Fidel. It's not an alliance created by Raul. So I think it's strongly based on the personal friendship between Fidel and Hugo Chavez. And I think that this relation will go down and down under the Raul government. I think the influence, I cannot imagine any Venezuelan influence in Cuba's domestic affairs. I think the influence is going the other way around, because you see also that these missions in Venezuela has been an idea managed by Fidel Castro, and also the further militarization of Venezuelan policy is partly the result of Cuban influence. So let me just come to the current foreign policy under Raúl. I think Raúl Castro, first of all, represents a different type of regime based on an internal consensus within the political leadership, based on institutions and based on personal loyalty to the president. So I see a shift from a charismatic authoritarian regime under Fidel to a rather bureaucratic institutionalized authoritarianism. So what did these recent cabinet changes mean for Cuba's internal and external situation? I think I would explain it with four factors. One of them... the end of Fidelism. The second one message would be the militarization of politics. The third, the institutionalization of the revolution. Fourth, charismatics and reformers are really not welcome. And fifth, this is more speculative, I see more an external opening and closure, in domestic politics. So I think we had extraordinary shifts in Cuba's foreign policy. If you look at the number of foreign ministers Cuba in 50 years had 6 foreign ministers, and 4 of them had been changed in the last 17 years. So this makes like they had been in office for an average of 4 years, nearly like a democratic regime. So the current minister had been living in the United States for 11 years. He knows very well, I think, U.S. policies. And maybe this is a sign for a transition under Raúl from this Cuban exceptionalism to Cuban normalization. Normalization started, first of all, in Latin America. Cuba has normal diplomatic relations with all Latin American countries. 5 presidents, Latin American presidents, visited Cuba in the last 2 months. Cuba is now fully integrated in the Rio Group, despite of the democracy clause. And I think while Chavez is in a really mess because of falling oil prices, Cuba is very slowly establishing privileged relationship, not with Mexico, with Brazil, I think, because of biofuel. You say that like this? Yeah. Biofuel. Sorry, my English is not so brilliant. also because of investment from Brazil, because if we think of the real food crisis Cuba is experiencing, Brazil is a strategic partner on the food industry. Brazil promotes Cuba's full integration in the hemisphere. I think it's very likely that the Brazilians, and not Chavez, not Morales, will ask at the next summit for Cuba's gradual integration in the inter-American system. Maybe not starting with the OAS, but with the IDB, but something will happen on that. So I think we can distinguish 3 cycles in Cuba's external policy under Raúl Castro. The first one is the hemisphere, where we can distinguish equal relations between Cuba, Bolivia, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and the Caribbean, and rather asymmetric relations with Mexico and Brazil as the 2 regional powers. The key for this normalization will be, for sure, the dialogue, the so-announced dialogue by both parts with the United States. I think Cuba is preparing for that in that moment. In the second circle, you have Canada, the EU, and Spain as stable economic partners. All 3 guaranteed Cuba's economic survival in the 19th. In the third circle are China, Russia, and other international partners, which are culturally very distant to Cuba and could never replace emotional partners such as the United States and Spain for Cuba. Let me just have a quick look at the policies of the quintet, you say, of the five key actors, Latin America, the U.S., Canada, Spain, and the EU, I think our policies are not so different as we might have thought. But, I mean, the main factor is still the United States sanctions, because very different to all other transatlantic partners, the main target of the U.S.-Cuba policy is not a gradual transition to democracy, but the regime's breakdown. This hasn't changed over the years and is still the case. So this explains also why the main partners of U.S.-Cuba policy are the dissidents and the opposition. And for all other actors, they are... it's first of all the regime, because we think that a gradual transition will start from above, from the government. Maybe we are mistaken. We are all mistaken. We don't know. But there are strong elements of engagement in U.S. policies, just to mention the medicine and food supplies. So the U.S. is now the fifth Cuban export, the Cuban market in the world. So I think this shows that the U.S. is the natural market for Cuba, not the EU, not Canada. And we have also... again, people-to-people contacts, remittances, some restrictions were recently lifted by the new Obama government, and I think we see a shift towards engagement. In Latin America, we have engagement without any precondition. They didn't apply the democracy clause. There is no political dialogue with Cuba on human rights. This marks a bit the difference to the Europeans, to Spain and Canada's policy towards Cuba. And we have now Cuba as a kind of development model in Latin America, which is mainly governed by the left. So we have a new recognition of Cuba in Latin America, although not in the hemisphere. So we have Canada and Spain. Their policy is based on constructive engagement. Canada has been the most stable Cuban partner in since the 90s, at least, or maybe since the 70s. But Spain is a rather shifting partner, because Cuba is in the U.S. and Spain is part of the domestic debate, of the domestic polarization between the Socialist Party, now is governing the Socialist Party, and the Conservative Party. So there has always been a shift in policies. I mean, there's a consensus on engagement in Spain, but there's no consensus on if we should emphasize political pressure or more this constructive engagement and political dialogue with the Cuban regime. So we have a constant shift in Spanish-Cuba policy. Now we have a shift towards engagement. But in Canada, I think we have more a policy of the state, which is absolutely absent in Spain. We don't have a consensus on Cuba and Spain. Let's look to EU policies. The EU applies a policy of conditioned engagement, which is not the same as constructive engagement. I think Spanish and EU policies are very closely linked, and in a certain sense, Brussels has been a mirror of Madrid's policy towards Cuba. So we have recently these three policy shifts. In 1996, an initiative of the conservative Spanish government the EU approves a common position on Cuba, which means a double democratic conditionality by the agreements the EU has with every single partner and by this common position. Then in 2003, again, the Spanish conservative government tried to implement these four sanctions on Cuba, which has been then last year eliminated following, again, a Spanish initiative by the socialist government to normalize relations with Cuba. Now, I think... The results of our engagement policy are rather poor. If we look at the last 20 years of relations between Cuba and the EU, I mean, there's no cooperation agreement between the EU and Cuba. The political dialogue has been steadily interrupted, and there are no visible results. The only really constant element in our policy is economic engagement, investment and trade in Cuba. The EU is now... the second trade partner and the second investor in Cuba. So I think even if engagement is the common denominator of EU's Cuba policy, there is no real consensus, and every member state follows their own policy towards Cuba. Even the European Commission, we have the situation that the Commission signed an agreement to reestablish development cooperation with the Cuban regime, and Spain did the same, but no other member states did that. So I would like to show a bit, to finish nearly, the six paradoxes of EU policies. So we have Spain imposing a democratic conditionality that it has never applied at a bilateral level because Cuba is a full member of the Ibero-American Community of States without any democracy clause. So then the EU has no cooperation agreement, but member states has 20 bilateral agreements with Cuba. The EU has an office with Cuba, but there's no cooperation between in the last 5 years, so nobody knows what they have been done in this period of time. So fourth, Cuba is part of the CARIFORUM and fully integrated in the Caribbean, but it has not signed the regional cooperation agreement with the European Union. Then, in general, we have the common position, but no common policy. And every year, such a small island as Cuba, which is of absolutely no strategic importance, apart from transatlantic relations for the EU, we have every year debate on EU policy towards Cuba because of the common position. And we'll see how it ends this year, because this year we have the Czech Republic has now the presidency of the EU, and the Czechs are very much interested, also for domestic reasons, to put more pressure on the Cuban regime, while Spain is now in favor of constructive engagement and an open political dialogue with the regime. So we don't know how it will end and if Spain again will win in EU policies towards Cuba. So I think both the Czech Republic and Spain uses Cuba for domestic reasons, Spain because of the internal polarization between both political parties, and the Czech Republic because they see Cuba as part of their own history, which is a full mistake from my, I think, but they do that, and they want to obtain more international profile by singling out the Cuban case. So to conclude, I think, in general, it's very amazing to see that Cuba is nearly fully recognized by the international community, but without any sign of political opening. There is no for me at the moment. There are very few steps on the economic front to survive, but nothing on the political front, or nearly nothing. In this sense, I think Cuba's foreign policy is a real success story and highly supportive to the regime's main interest to stay in power. So I think, therefore, it is very doubtful if engagement is really working in closed authoritarian regimes. And I think probably without lifting the embargo, we will never know if engagement is the real answer to authoritarian regimes. But I think the only opportunity we have is to agree all on constructive engagement, on dialogue, and on cooperation, and on economic cooperation, because the regime will lose its main argument to justify a closed regime with the external threat. I mean, this is no news under the word. You have heard it many, many times. But this is our vision in Europe, because we think that democratic opening will only occur from above, from the regime. We don't think that there will be a social upheaval or that dissidents and the exile will have considerable influence. We don't think so. But maybe we are all mistaken. We don't know because change has not yet started in Cuba. So I think the embargo had been the real stabilization factor for the regime. And it's also the key for Cuba's democratic opening. But both Raúl and Obama wants to see a gradual approach because Obama wants to avoid an open conflict with parts of the Cuban exile, and he wants to avoid also to recognize openly that, I mean, it has been a complete failure, Cuba policy, for the last 50 years. And Raúl wants to sustain a bit more this image of the external threat for reasons of domestic, which I've already explained. So I think Cuba will be the most important test case for Washington's re-engagement in the Americas. And I think there could be and there should be a very close cooperation between Brazil and the U.S. And I'm sure that when last week, the summit, Lula and Obama, for sure, they talked about Cuba. I don't know what's the result. But I think there should be a dialogue between at least several key players. I'm referring to this five countries, Brazil, Canada, Spain, Mexico, and the U.S., to coordinate a bit more our policies, because if not, they are absolutely counterproductive. Thank you very much. And thanks for the, I think, 10 extra minutes. I'm so sorry for that.
Thank you very much. We now move to Dr. Kirk.
Thank you. As a self-declared techno-peasant, I'll stay here and won't trouble you with overheads. Many thanks to Peter for the opportunity to be here and to Jessica, who handled the arrangements superbly. It's great that CSIS has brought in different people, different voices, to give their opinions. I'm the third Canadian, and so don't be shocked at the Canadian invasion of Washington. I'm a full-time academic and a part-time consultant. I've been going to Cuba an average two or three times a year since 1976. I work with a number of Canadian and European companies that have invested in or exported to Cuba, particularly since 1994. I've worked with the Swiss government and the Canadian government in different levels as a consultant, as advisor. And I also spent 2 weeks as an interpreter with the Premier of Nova Scotia in meetings with Fidel Castro and Carlos Laje and other people in the Cuban government. So today I want to talk about Cuba's international relations, and I'll fill in some of the gaps that other folks left. Some of my gems of wisdom have been stolen by my two the two previous speakers. I want to speak in general terms. I want to speak about Latin America, Caribbean relations with Cuba, and the area that I work most in, Canada-Cuba relations. And all in 15 minutes, if it works out. It feels a bit like one of these speed dating things where you sit down with a person for 5 minutes and then you move on 5 minutes later. So I'll speed date as quickly.
You can take a few extra.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Peter. Very timely topic, very timely. We have a vibrant president. We in Canada would love an Obama. If you have a second one, please send them along. I think that there have been some reforms in Cuba, particularly during the early years of the Raul Castro government. The hurricane which then came along and caused $10 billion worth of damage. That's four times the gross income from tourism for years. Had a major impact, and reforms have slowed down since then. Should any of you be interested in looking at Cuba in the special period, I'd like to do some self-promotion. This is a book called A Contemporary Cuba Reader that I co-edited, and all profits from this go to hurricane relief in Cuba. It was published by Roman Littlefield and is available easily. It's about $20, and all profits, as I say, go to hurricane relief in Cuba. I think that what President Obama has done so far is dramatic. I commend him and the people advising him for having done that, but it was about time. The international community is delighted to see that U.S. policy is finally recognizing what the entire planet has been saying for many years. Two figures, 185-3. Israel, the United States, and Palau. Palau, I Googled it because I wasn't too sure where it was, has a population of 21,000, about that of George Washington University. So it's George Washington University, Israel, and the U.S. against the world. Second figure, 0-10. George W. Bush was the 10th American president vowing to bring about regime change. So far, the record is 0-10. I coach a soccer team in Nova Scotia. I still play soccer despite my advanced age. And if I play the same team 10 times and we lost 10 times, I change the players, the strategy, and the tactics. So it's great to see that the strategy is changing. 1961, January the 3rd, the U.S. broke diplomatic relations with Cuba. In 1962, the embargo was brought into effect. The idea, the objective, was to isolate Cuba. Guess who got isolated? CARICOM governments, the heads of government meeting in Santiago, in Cuba, in December. This is on the 8th of December, the final communique, and I quote, we call, this is the heads of the government of the Caribbean countries, we call for an end to the economic, commercial, and financial embargo of the Republic of Cuba and urge the government of the United States of America to heed the overwhelming call of the members of the United Nations and to lift with immediate effect the unjust economic, commercial, and financial embargo imposed upon the Republic of Cuba. This is the CARICOM. Despite the divided European opinions, which Suzanne spoke about extremely well, the U.S. Recently, as you will know, the foreign minister of Ireland was in Cuba. The French government trying to do a démarche around everybody else, and Jack Lang to try and figure out what France's, how they can corner the market. But the best evidence of the need for the normalization of relations comes from the visit of 13 national leaders to Cuba since October, when Lula first came, then Hu Jintao from China, and then his Russian counterpart. All this has taken place since October. The OAS suspended Cuba in 1962, and again the idea was to isolate Cuba. All but two governments, Mexico and Canada, suspended Cuba. It's very interesting if you look at the political landscape of Latin America now, you will see that it's not five, it's eight Latin American presidents have visited Cuba since early January. So not just Hugo Chavez, but Martin Torrijos from Panama, Michelle Bachelet from Chile, Cristina Fernandez from Argentina, Alvaro Colom from Guatemala, Rafael Correa from Ecuador, Manuel Zelaya, who brought a massive big hat for Fidel to wear from Honduras, and the Leonel Fernandez from the Dominican Republic. Rafael Calderon is due from Mexico in April, and Evo Morales is also expected in April or May. In boxing terminology, Cuba, population 11.3 million, punches way above its weight, way above its weight. Mike Erisman and I have just done a book on Cuban medical internationalism, and it was a humbling project to see that this tiny country has 40,000 medical staff, more than all G8 nations together working in the developed world, which is quite extraordinary. 1.5 million people have had eye surgery for free, including the officer who executed Che Guevara in Bolivia. Talk about symbolic humanitarian revenge to save the eyesight of the guy who executed Che Guevara. 50,000 medical students from Latin America and the Caribbean are being trained for free, 50,000 in Cuba and Venezuela. 23,000 kids from Chernobyl have been treated and are still treated every year for free in Cuba. So the medical internationalism has had tremendous impact. And we argue in our book, in terms of soft power, has had a tremendous impact in winning the hearts and minds of many countries. Four events in recent weeks also indicate, speak volumes of Latin America's interest for the need to change. The visit of Lula here, and I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when Lula and Obama sat down to find out what happened there. The South American defense ministers meeting on March the 10th condemned the U.S. policy. The Argentine Minister of Defense said, and I quote, "Today we see favorable conditions with the new president in the U.S. to put an end to this discriminatory and unjust condition. This is a pending issue in the region." The Argentine Minister of Defense. The election of President Funes in El Salvador last week. Who would have thought that the leader of the FMLN would be president, elected democratically in El Salvador? Quite extraordinary. And President Arias, not wanting to be the last country to not have diplomatic relations with Cuba, announced that Costa Rica would normalize its relations and exchange ambassadors. So, in 1962, Cuba was suspended from the OAS to isolate it again, and again, guess who's isolated? So, quite extraordinary. That's Latin America and the Caribbean. Where does Canada fit into this? The key word to discuss Canadian-Cuban relations is normal. Canadians are quiet, easygoing, boring people. We're the Boy Scouts of the world. I would argue, however, that every single country, apart from Israel, Palau, and the United States, has a normal relationship with the United States. We have major disagreements on democratization, but we agree to disagree. Normal means that every year, Canada condemns the U.S. embargo at the General Assembly, but also criticizes the abuses of democratic, civil, and political human rights in Cuba. But it respects Cuban sovereignty. It doesn't give funding to groups to overthrow the organization of Cuba. We agree to disagree. We exchange diplomats on a regular basis. The foreign minister of former foreign minister of Canada visited Cuba twice. The former prime minister, but two, Jean Chrétien, also visited Cuba. Many ups and downs. Several prime ministers got on well, particularly Jean Chrétien in the early years and Pierre Trudeau. Fidel Castro, along with Jimmy Carter and Leonard Cohen, what a great trio, were honorary pallbearers at the funeral of Pierre Trudeau in Montreal. We have a policy of constructive engagement. Does it work? Well, not really. If the objective is to bring about political change in Cuba, no. And I was at a meeting with very exasperated Canadian diplomats who sort of said, the carrot and the stick, nothing works. And they're dead right. Cuba marches to its own drummer and always has and will. So it depends upon how you define success. Havana is not prepared to change its political system. It also is clear that it no longer feels threatened by a hyperpower 90 miles away, but at the same time feels concerned enough to make that, as I think Suzanne mentioned, the basis for its stability. It is not prepared to lower its guard. It's not prepared to make any concessions, and understandably so. What is clear is that we have in Canada a solid, normal relationship despite profound ideological differences. I have an article coming out which has the title of What Canadian Politics Might Show American Politics on Towards Cuba. If anyone's interested, please see me afterwards and I'd be happy to, or give me a card and I'd be happy to email it to you. The reality is that Canada has the single largest foreign investor in Cuba. Canada sends the lion's share of tourists to Cuba, 800,000 last year. I come from a city of 350,000, and every year, this is from the travel section of the local paper, so if I wanted to, I could fly to Cayo Coco for $600 for a week, to Varadero for $450, this is all-inclusive. I'll be taking reservations afterwards if anyone's interested, to Holguín for $700, to Santa Clara, to Camagüey, to Santiago de Cuba. I think there are 20 Canadian cities that have flights to Cuba throughout the tourist season. So we have a normal relationship. And again, 800,000 tourists. Canada has regular daily service to Havana from Toronto. Trade is not spectacular. It's about $1.2 billion. And to put that in context, that's about perhaps what Canada-U.S. relation trade is in 16 hours of one single day. We have agreements with about 30 Canadian universities. The one I teach at, we send 25 students to spend a semester in Cuba every year. And we have a variety of NGO connections, church, development, ecological, etc. So what can be learned? First of all, the alternative to constructive engagement is far worse. It is an abject failure and has been for 50 years. Bluster, sabotage, terrorism, dependence upon intelligence from exiles coming from the United States have not worked. Again, 0 and 10. Secondly, dialogue and respect for sovereignty are useful. They're not the be-all and end-all, but they're useful. Trade can be greatly enhanced. And will undoubtedly do more than threats, but it has to be bilateral trade. And I've worked with enough Canadian companies that have investments in Cuba to see there is a knock-on impact. There's a knock-on impact in tourism. There's a knock-on impact in terms the way Cubans think in terms of dealing with business and dealing with trade. So for Canada and Cuba, their bilateral relationship is mutually beneficial. It's also mutually beneficial for domestic politics because Canadians have a great chip on their shoulder looking at foreign policy and the impact upon Washington. So as a result, it shows our independence from Washington. Number of concluding thoughts. It's difficult to overcome the black hole of five decades of enmity, but it's important to recognize, and I think Obama does that, that 10 presidents later, Cuba is not isolated. Cuba has survived. Cuba's GDP, as Mike showed, has improved, and Cuba is not about to collapse. Secondly, U.S. policy towards Cuba is a failed policy. I think the analysis of Senator Lugar's staff report, the Brookings Institution roadmap, generally are pretty solid. It's time to turn the page. It's also important not to underestimate Cuban pride and nationalism. We tend to believe that because there's criticism of people in Cuba, that people are waiting to embrace a made-in-Washington solution. Not so. Cuba, there's a sense of dignity, of respect for sovereignty that is profound, cannot be quantified, and which is very difficult to explain unless you have experienced it. So wishful thinking should not take the place of realistic analysis on Cuba. Dialogue with Cuba, sincere dialogue, is the way to go. It's also important to bear in mind the pink tide in Latin America, the number of socialist and social democratics who have been elected. It's also important to bear in mind that victories in Peru and Mexico were by slim margins. Otherwise, we would have López Obrador as president in Mexico. So the pink tide would be even more challenging. Very high expectations of what the United States is going to do when Obama goes to Trinidad and Tobago April the 17th. This is an extremely important moment. The old adage is true. You don't get a second opportunity to make a first impression. 2 minutes, if it's okay. So don't underestimate the Cuban model. There are five concluding thoughts, which are in, this is the concluding chapter of a book that Mike Erisman and I had written. And I made 50 copies. If anyone wants them, it's only a slim read, but there are five comments, there are five conclusions that are here. Henry Kissinger, about 30 years ago, mentioned that it was not in the U.S. Interests to have a relationship of perpetual aggression with Cuba. He was right. The Lugar staff report says, and I quote, "Staff believes that the U.S. government should begin treating Cuba as it does other nations with whom it has fundamental disagreements, but where engagement advances broader interests." I couldn't have said it better. So April the 17th, I urge whoever is making decisions to remember that you've got a great opportunity, and the hemisphere is waiting. The world is waiting, apart from Palau and Israel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The floor is open for questions. If you wish to ask a question, please raise your hand, state your name and your affiliation, and if you direct the question to any one of the panelists in particular, please so state. Questions, please. I'll ask the first question then. Just to look at the Inter-American system and mention the OAS. The Inter-American Democratic Charter states basically that democracy is the coin of the realm in the hemisphere, and that states in the hemisphere have the obligation to promote and defend it. The OAS has suspended Cuba as a member. What do the panelists see as the options for the OAS in dealing with Cuba? This is not this is sort of international diplomacy, but it has very much to do not only with the positions of the states that are members of the OAS, but also the OAS observers that that represent other countries.
Well, I'll just throw a quick one in. Again, I don't know if there were any no questions because we were so good or because we were so lousy. But in any case, in response to Peter's question, obviously you could take several approaches to this. You could take, I think, the European approach, which Suzanne mentioned, which says you make it an issue which you don't follow up on. The other thing I think perhaps would be, and this is more difficult, but it gets you into some of these issues of ideological rigidity that I was talking about. Clearly, I think certainly the United States and probably most members of the OAS, although that may be changing a bit with the pink tide, would define democracy in essentially a Western liberal sense, okay? But that's not necessarily the only definition of what a democratic system may be. There is kind of this distinction that's sometimes made in my area of political science between kind of procedural democracy, which is a more Western liberal, an Anglo-Saxon view of it, if you will, and then the idea of substantive democracy, which is more an idea of a government which makes a serious effort to address basic human needs and doesn't worry too much about the nature of the government or the political system which takes that action. So I guess, although I'm probably being Pollyannish here, but one could expand the definition of democracy that the OAS is talking about. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, but that would be one way to look at it.
The Inter-American Democratic Charter does lay out the definition of democracy for the members of the OAS, as just as a point of reference.
Well, that's why I said it would be a difficult thing to do that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see the European experience because we have regular summits between the EU, the Caribbean, and the Latin Americans, and Cuba is a full member. Cuba's always participating. And what the Europeans did, they said to the Rio Group, you should decide on that. We will not take this decision because of our internal problems to get to a consensus on Cuba. And maybe it's not the solution for the OAS because the decision would be clear. So, I mean, the only opponent would be the United States. But maybe there's a gradual approach, to admit Cuba again as an observer or whatever. They wouldn't probably accept that. I would also suggest to look very closely at Latin American partners, maybe to create a kind of working group between what I've mentioned, Brazil, Mexico, and Canada and the U.S., maybe. It would be interesting to have a European there also because we all have regular summits with Latin America without any coordination between these summits. So I think it would be interesting to do something more international-focused on Cuba or, if possible, with Cuba. This might be the approach. Or you could also say maybe we could admit again Cuba to have access to the IDB, maybe not to start with the OAS, which is politically much more sensitive.
Three quick thoughts, and the question is excellent. I agree with Michael that there are several different interpretations of democracy, and the Western liberal one is not the only one, even though the language in the OAS charter may state otherwise. That said, if we look at the tradition of elections in Latin America in the past three decades, there have been many which have not been overly democratic. So that the same, the reality is that the Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas was probably elected president and didn't take power, and that there have been several military coups where people took power. So there's a tradition of ignoring that particular aspect. The third thing is that the realist school of politics would indicate, come on, if everybody gets on with Cuba, what's the point in not accepting Cuba back into the club? The question is, and Suzanne mentioned this as well, does Cuba want to be back in the OAS? And I'm not too sure that it does at this stage. It's got why should it? What could it gain from that when it's got fantastic relations with every country in the hemisphere and now is a member of the Rio group? So it remains to be seen as to how significant a factor the OAS would be in Cuba.
Thank you. Question here.
Yeah, my name is Sonia Schott. I am with the German Press Agency. I would like to know what is your read regarding the most recently embargo flexibilization, and what is your perception regarding the role of the Cuban American community here in the U.S. In what kind of impact will have in the probably a future lift of the embargo? Thank you.
Well, I'll make a couple opening comments and then let everybody tell me where I'm wrong again. Oh, okay. Make a few opening comments. I think certainly, you know, what people say is one problem with normalization of U.S.-Cuban relations, that it's perhaps until very recently been a captive of domestic politics in the United States. The policy has flowed more from the domestic arena than it necessarily has from the foreign policy arena. And within that context, as you suggest, the Cuban community in the United States being a very influential player. And I think there's a lot of indications that say that is lessening somewhat now. There's generational change going on within the Cuban community in the U.S. In other words, second and third generation Cubans for whom these old political quarrels are not particularly high priority concerns. So that would be something that would suggest that there is an opening to move it out of the arena of domestic politics and more into the area of, shall we say, pragmatic foreign policy concerns. On the other hand, there are important elements of U.S. policy that are written into law, the Torricelli Law, the Helms-Burton Law, where, of course, Congress, I think, would have to take some sort of action in negating or rescinding those laws. And as I tell some of my students, in the U.S. political system, and particularly Congress, there's an awfully lot of negative power built into that system. In other words, it's easier to stop things from happening than to make things happen. And I think we can see with some of the attempts recently to open up the travel. You have one or two people in Congress who are well-placed and maybe well-connected with the Cuban community, and particularly the hardline Cuban community, who can create substantial difficulties in trying to make alterations in terms of existing laws and existing legislation. So on the one hand, I would say yes, in a very general sense, it's being moved out of the domestic arena, a lessening influence of the Cuban community. But on the other hand, particularly with things having to do with Congress and legislative action, they may still be able, given some of their influential friends in Congress, to exert kind of a negative power on the whole process.
Yeah, from the European perspective, it's more to go back to the years of Clinton, no? This people-to-people contact. But at the moment, I can't see any shift, any change in U.S. policy. It's only to get gradually back to the former policy. So I can't see any real changes there. And I think it's also important, not to give up democratic principles, because Cuba is not a democracy. We shouldn't forget that. So there are some political human rights principles to be respected too. And I'm not in favor of economic sanctions, but I think we should also take into account that we have a democratic commitment and that Latin America and the hemisphere has a democratic commitment. And this should not be forgotten.
Cuban Americans, I think, originally during the campaign, President Obama, president at the time, said that Cuban Americans would be allowed to go back to Cuba anytime. And I think that to allow them to go back once a year is a significant improvement, but I think the original commitment he made should be respected. I think that American citizens should also be allowed the human right to travel to Cuba. I say that with some trepidation because the 800,000 Canadians who are there will be squeezed out by you folks. So don't all go at once.
Ms. Gracious, you talk about that now with Raúl Castro, their relation with Venezuela will go down and down, you said. I was wondering why you said that, if you could talk a little more about that. And I don't know if the other panelists share this view.
No, if you look at recent Cuban foreign policy, you can see a shift towards a closer approach to Brazil. Lula had been visiting the island with a huge delegation of businessmen. So I think there's something on there. So Brazil is again on the Cuban agenda, of maybe for the first time in their history. And I think the fact that Carlos Lache, he has also been very involved in this relationship between Cuba and Venezuela, and Carlos Lache is not there anymore. So I think this strategic relationship is very much criticized also in Cuba. We had a discussion in Madrid last year with 10 Cuban academics, and they saw this very critically, and they said, oh, we should diversify our external relations and not again focus on one strategic partner, being conscious that maybe Venezuela will end up in a huge mess, at least on the economic front. I see very, very important problems there for Venezuela. The economic relations will be maintained, but on the political front, the ideological component will be much lower than under Fidel, I guess. Yeah.
I don't agree. I think that foreign relations are not based on charisma alone. And yes, the chemistry, as if we're talking about two racehorses, the chemistry between Raul and Chavez is not the same. But I think that the Chavez government has to deliver health care. The Barrio Adentro program has saved 347,000 lives. 95% of the Venezuelan population have been reached by Cuban doctors. Venezuela needs those Cuban doctors, needs those teachers. So I think that, and in terms of the economic, if you look at the 98,000 barrels of oil that Cuba's getting a day, Cuba needs that oil, so at excellent prices. And I think if you look at the number of development projects, if you look at the investment of Venezuela in everything from chemical projects to 300 agricultural projects, the $5 billion petrochemical plant, involved joint ventures in fishing, in railways, in cement, in nickel, in telecommunications, the economic ties, which are worth $7 billion a year, I think that they will continue. Yes, I think that Brazil will become an extremely important character in terms of Cuban, an influence of Cuban foreign policy, but I disagree with Susanna in the sense that I think that Venezuela will still be extraordinarily important.
No, we don't disagree.
We don't disagree, okay.
Yeah, I would just, unfortunately, come down on John's side a little bit. I suppose the stereotype is, of course, that Castro conducts foreign relations on a very charismatic approach, and Raul is the pragmatist. And if Raul is indeed the pragmatist, then it would seem to me to be very pragmatic to maintain that relationship with Venezuela and not see it deteriorate for whatever reasons. That's not to exclude Brazil or any other Latin American countries from a tighter relationship between Havana and, let's say, Brazil. I know several years ago I was invited to a conference, as a matter of fact, in Brazil, that some Cuban think tanks had organized, and they were very much interested at that time. And this was before ALBA and all of these things developed. They were very much interested in terms of the relationships with Brazil, the relationships with Mercosur in general. So they certainly have been thinking about this dimension of their foreign relations for some time. So to the extent that now there are opportunities there for that relationship to become more prominent and more important, I definitely think that will probably occur. I don't think that conversely means some sort of a downsizing of the Cuban-Venezuelan relationship.
I'd be grateful if the panelists would go a little more into the relationship between China and Cuba.
There are a lot of Chinese buses in Havana. I think that China's relationship with Cuba, I don't think, is particularly ideological. I think China is looking for cheap resources, particularly minerals, wherever it can. And hence, Hu Jintao not only went to Cuba, but went to half a dozen other Latin American countries. Regardless of ideology, I think China is trying to position itself as a major, even greater economic force. And Cuba is just happens to be along the way. I don't see any ideological, strong ideological influence or possibilities of development there.
Well, again, I have to admit a bit of ignorance on this because it's not been a major dimension of my research, but I think one can say in general that China has been trying to develop a higher profile, a higher presence in Latin America in general. And that being the case, to the extent that Cuba is seen as kind of a major player on a symbolic level, if not on a practical level, in terms of Latin American affairs, it doesn't surprise me that there have been attempts to enhance and expand the relationships between China and Cuba. And again, I guess as John said, I think it's very pragmatic in the sense that just as Cuba has had some tense relations in the past with the Soviet Union, it hasn't always been smooth sailing, to say the least. Likewise with China at one time. They were engaged in similar ideological bickering. So I think, again, that's kind of in the past, and it's a much more pragmatic kind of relationship. And I think if you do look at the trade figures, you do see that, again, there is an expansion of trade between China and Cuba. Now, realistically, you compare Cuba with Brazil or Argentina or Mexico or any other Latin American country, Cuba can't be a very high priority in a pure economic sense from the Chinese perspective. But I do think in terms of a somewhat symbolic sense, if they are interested in expanding their relations with Latin America, then it makes eminent sense to make Cuba part of that equation.
Yeah, but I think there are also ideological components, or if you look at the economic model, I think China has an influence in Cuba. I mean, Cuba will never go the Chinese way because it's of socialist capitalism or whatever you would like to call it. But there are parallels, or they are looking at agriculture, for example, privatization of the agriculture sector. They are looking at what could happen, what would be useful for Cuba, because Cuba's main economic problem is to get food, no? Because they import 80% of food. So this is the real problem, and therefore China might be a model, or they are looking at it.
Hi, Lilia Lopez with the Washington Office on Latin America. I was wondering if any of the panelists could address the role of Chile and Argentina in discussions of Cuba's sort of this new era in Cuba's relationship with Latin America as a whole. I think we've seen that both countries have an interest in human rights and democracy on the island, and also that they were very instrumental in the Rio Summit Declaration. Vice President Biden is going to be visiting Chile in a few weeks leading up to the summit, and so I think that's something of interest.
I think that the visit of President Bachelet was mixed results. I think the visit of President Kirchner was more successful. My sense, speaking with Cuban academics and diplomats, is that this is one step in a multi-step process of normalization with the hemisphere. There's no particularly strong relationship, but at the same time, and Cuba agrees to disagree with some aspects, but at the same time, the trade possibilities are seen as being very attractive, and having the support of Chile and Argentina in multilateral discussions is seen as being strategically important. But I think it's a temperate relationship as opposed to being anything particularly substantial.
Comment on Carlos Echeverria is my name. Any question on Russia? Is Russia taking advantage of the situation between Cuba and the United States?
Well, again, from what I have seen, that yes, there has been, particularly in an economic sense, there has been an expansion of Cuban and Russian relations. Obviously, given the disintegration of the Soviet Union, given the disintegration of the Soviet bloc in general, in other words, late 80s, early 1990s, at least my view was there was little, if anything, there in terms of any kind of relationship. That obviously is changing, particularly in an economic sense, I think. On the other hand, I would be a little bit skeptical as to how high Russia is on Cuba's foreign policy agenda, what priority it would be given. I think some of the other things that we've talked about here, Latin America, Venezuela, the Europeans, and perhaps even China also, would probably have higher priority right now in terms of Cuba's foreign policy agenda. So yes, have there been changes? Has there been an expansion of the relationship? Yes. Is it a top priority item? My sense is no, not at this time.
A very brief note. I think that it's important to bear in mind the geostrategic value of relationships between the concern of the Kremlin with the idea of having Poland and the Czech Republic having the potential U.S. missile defense establishment, and therefore I think Cuba can be brought in the analysis, Cuba and Venezuela, as a means of, look, if you're going to do that, then, you know, maybe we can look at Venezuela and Cuba. It's posturing, and hopefully common sense on both sides will prevail.
Ramon Daubon, the Skill Group. We spend hours in meetings like this and others obsessing about Cuba, reading the tea leaves of what's happening in Cuba. Yet when you look at what is obviously an obsessive relationship between Cuba and the United States, if you look at the relationship, Cuba doesn't have a single policy that's aimed against the United States. Yet the U.S. insists on this. We try to understand what happens inside Cuba very much, and we read tea leaves and we talk about who changes and who comes and who goes, etc. We don't try to understand the obsession on this side, and if anything, the dysfunctionality of the relationship arises from the United States side, not from the Cuban side. Have we tried to understand why the U.S. is so obsessed about this?
Well, I guess as the American on the panel, I'm going to have to answer that. I'm not sure I want to, but I do think... And this may be changing somewhat with the Obama administration, all right? But I do think there's definitely kind of a psychological dynamic in U.S.-Cuban relations and on both sides of the equation, some of which we've talked about, the nationalism, the concern with effective sovereignty on the part of the Cubans. I know. I'm going to go over to the other side. And I think there's often a similar kind of psychological dynamic at work in the United States. I think, again, I'm just speculating, amateur psychoanalysis, that it might be difficult for any administration to take a dramatic initiative in terms of normalizing relations, particularly without any kind of conditions on the Cubans. Because that, quite frankly, allows the Cubans to say, we won. And I think particularly when Fidel was there, it was going to be very difficult for any administration to allow Fidel to sit there as it was in the cartoon and say, not only have we succeeded in frustrating them, but we've won. I think there is a certain amount of that involved. And so there's all the things that we talk about in terms of the political dynamics, the economic dynamics, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's also perhaps been a bit of a psychological dynamic. We have to recognize, I think, even though all of us are very interested in Cuba and have spent probably our careers on it, that probably... very few administrations have been willing to expend a lot of political capital in terms of normalizing relations with Cuba. There's little to be gained in terms of political capital, perhaps, and I'm talking particularly domestically, in terms of doing that. And so these other than dimensions, these other dynamics, which you call it obsessive, have kicked in to a certain extent. So I think there's an element of that. Now, that may be changing with the Obama administration. On the other hand, I tend to be a pessimist on these things in terms of normalization of relations. And if it doesn't happen, I can say, ha, I was right. And if it does happen, I can say, well, that's nice, I was wrong. But
Yeah, I think the problem, I think there's a mutual obsession. There's also an obsession in Cuba with this anti-Americanism, which is one of the founding principles of the revolution at the end. So there's a mutual obsession. And I think the problem is that both Spain and the U.S. are emotional partnerships or emotional partners. So I would also say that maybe the embargo, economic sanction, has been mutually interesting because they contributed to a certain stabilization as a counterproductive effect maybe, but we didn't talk any word on the migration pressure which might come from Cuba if there is a democratic opening. So there are many things. Maybe both sides are really interested in maintaining the status quo. I'm not so sure about that. And I think there is also this problem that the real Cuban internal politics is including the United States because of the real opposition is living in the United States. So you have really the U.S. as part of an internal Cuban conflict, a kind of extraterritorialization of domestic Cuban politics. This is also a huge problem.
I think part of the problem as well, in addition to the psychological black hole that exists, I think that the media coverage, the intelligence that's provided about Cuba tends to be already weighed down by the history. It's very difficult when you've had a tiny little country 90 miles away vowing to sort of to survive and using anti-Americanism so successfully and having U.S. government policy being so single-minded and so self-defeating in many ways. Came across, this is the annual threat assessment of the intelligence community for the House Permanent Select Committee of Intelligence on Cuba. I'd like to read from it. This is from Dennis C. Blair, Director of National Intelligence, dated 25th of February this year. We assess that Raul will continue his efforts to bolster Havana's international legitimacy by projecting a more moderate political image. It's a bit paternalistic and a bit simplistic. It goes on. Nevertheless, Cuba almost certainly will remain heavily involved behind the scenes in counseling and supporting authoritarian populist governments in Latin America and otherwise seeking to undermine U.S. influence across the region. It's a little, you know, these authoritarian populist governments are actual democracies. They were elected. You know, so it seems a bit simplistic. It also goes on about Cuba, although an economic basket case. Well, Canada's not doing too well, and as far as I see, the U.S. isn't doing too well. Yet, you know, we always look at the other side. Cuba, though an economic basket case, can still influence the Latin American left because of its so-called anti-imperialist stance. It's too simplistic. You know, it's the real world has moved on, and it's time to turn the page.
Thank you all very much for having come. Please thank our panelists for their presentations. Thanks again.